Hi, and welcome to Collider Science. Here you find answers about cognition that you may or may not have asked yourself. This episode is hosted by Elisa Palme and Sophie Kühne. So sit back, relax, and enjoy this week's episode.
Menstruation is a topic that everyone knows about or has at least heard about once or twice in their life, maybe more often, I hope. And everyone, even when not menstruating themselves, is affected by. However, it's surprisingly little researched on some levels until now. And even though half of the world population experiences in their own body at some point in their life, we today are going to talk to Franziska Weinmehr, who is a PhD candidate in psychoneuroendocrinology, researching women's mental health in hormonal transitions at the University of Tübingen. And we will talk to her in our blog on reproductive hormones and their effect on the brain, or hormones in general and their effect on the brain. Welcome. We are excited to have you here today.
Thank you for inviting me and having me. I'm very excited for the podcast.
Okay, we're gonna start with our little beloved get-to-know game. So I'm gonna give you beginnings of sentences, and I would like you to complete them. As a kid, I always wanted to be.
I think that changed quite a bit, but I know that there was a time when I definitely wanted to become an astronaut. So I think traveling to the moon, that was something I really wanted to do as a kid.
That's really cool. I've read quite a lot about different Apollo missions semi-recently, so all the moon missions. So I also think that's really interesting. If I was an emoji, I would be?
Oh, definitely the sunflower. I really love sunflowers, and that's the emoji I use the most. Also in different contexts, so definitely the sunflower.
Nice.
I think we haven't had a flower so far. I think everyone so far always had emotion emojis, if I'm
not
mistaken.
No, we've had some brains.
Did we?
So for me, the sunflower still expresses emotions, but just sunny and warm emotions, yeah.
Yeah. No, of course. I just meant face emotions, like facial expression emojis. Yeah. True.
My favorite thing to do on a day off is?
Taking a walk, doing some yoga, and drinking coffee with friends.
Nice. Right now, I'm most fascinated by?
The transition to menopause and all its perspectives, I would say. That's also now the focus of my PhD and definitely something that I'm truly fascinated by.
So we're going to talk about this in more detail in a second.
I hope so.
I know it's time to call it a day when...
I tend to do to-do lists for the day, and I think it's definitely the time to call it a day if I finish the things that are on my to-do list. Of course, not always that happens, but definitely when I did that, then I'm done.
Nice.
Actually quite impressive, because I'm definitely not a to-do list person. I always wish I would be, but never.
Yeah, I kind of do these very small to-do lists. It's not then a to-do list for like weeks or months, but just for the day. And also, I think that I get a little bit better of estimating what I can do in a day, and that really helps me just to structure the day.
It makes sense. I also think it feels more satisfying to have just a list where you know, well, exactly what I did, compared to just rambling around and then noticing that you don't even know what exactly you did.
And also crossing it off. That's the thing that I love it for.
I think I always overestimate how much I can do. So I put things on my to-do list. I'm not good at keeping daily to-do lists. I have more like weekly to-do lists. But they feel like they never really finish, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I get that. Yeah, I know that this is also not something for everyone, but it works for me.
Okay. So you're a PhD student in Tübingen. Could you tell us a little more about what you studied and how you got where you are now.
So everything started when I did my bachelor's in psychology at the University of Leiden in the Netherlands. And I was very curious about the brain. And in psychology, you do have all different kinds of lectures about different kinds of topics, of course, also about mental health and psychotherapy and all of the different clinical theory, I would say. But then, of course, also you go into more cognitive science, or also the brain and neuroscience. And I really enjoyed that part of the neurological sciences that we did, neuropsychology. And especially during my semester abroad, I was able to choose some courses and take some courses that were more going into also the interaction of hormones and the brain. And I was so fascinated that I thought, let's give it a try for my master's. And that's what I did, and ended up doing my master's in neural and behavioral sciences at the University of Tübingen. And there I did also something like a research internship, I would call it like this, and then also my master thesis. And I all did that in the lab where I'm currently also a PhD student, and I got to know my amazing supervisor, Professor Birgit Dantel, who was doing fascinating work all about women's mental health and the interaction of hormones, the brain, and specifically this in a social affective context, so social and affective states and all that things that go together. And she had some projects directly after finishing my master thesis. And then I applied to one of these projects and ended up where I am, which is now a PhD project within an international research training group in Tübingen. And we're all doing in this group topics on women's mental health across the reproductive years, or the lifespan, I would call it. So ranging from puberty over the menstrual cycle, hormonal contraceptives. There are projects also on pregnancy, and then also a project on menopause, which is also what I'm currently doing. So that is basically the short introduction of how I ended up where I am at the moment.
That's very cool. So I would start with some questions about your topic. So we introduced you as working on psychoneuroendocrinology. Could you break this down a little bit and tell us what that means?
Of course. So I think that word, even though it is really a long word, it perfectly summarizes what we are doing in our group. And that's basically, if you break it down, so you have the psychological part. So that's that is how our thoughts and emotions interact with the brain in its structure and function, the neurological part, and then the hormones, the endocrinology part. And all of these together interact to shape basically our behavior, our mood, and mental health. So it's really an interdisciplinary field, and that is also what I really love about it. So I love that word, actually, because it so perfectly summarizes, if you break it down, what we do.
Okay. And you do research on hormones. So what are hormones exactly? Because I'm familiar with the brain. I have a grasp of psychology, but what are hormones and what do they do?
Yes. So what we specifically research or investigate are hormones, of course, the sex hormones that we have in the blood. But maybe we can summarize hormones like this, or I would always explain hormones, something like chemical messengers. And they travel through the bloodstream, and they can help different parts of the body and the brain to communicate. And you have all sorts of different hormones, from metabolic hormones to sex hormones like estrogen, progesterone, testosterone, but also lots and lots and lots of different other hormones that I probably all don't know all of them, but also stress hormones like cortisol. And all of these hormones, they regulate essential functions that we have. And of course, then in women, or females, I should better say, they change over time across the menstrual cycle or pregnancy, also after pregnancy and then during menopause. And basically, they carry messages from one part to the other part of the body. For example, now for the brain, where we have different receptors, you can think of them like locks And then the hormone is basically the key and it attaches to that. And then it does certain functions. And of course, in the brain, we have a lot of receptors for all kinds of different hormones, also for our sex hormones. That is also something that has been neglected for a long time, that we also have receptors for sex hormones, so estrogen, progesterone, all over the brain. So even though the sex hormones like estrogen, progesterone are produced in the women by the ovaries, or then the corpus luteum in the across the menstrual cycle, they travel through the blood because that's what hormones do. And then they can travel back to the brain and exert certain effects. So that's why it is so interesting to look at hormones not as distinct from neuroscience or from the brain, but just all in the system together, if that makes sense.
That actually makes a lot of sense. So that basically means the hormones are produced locally, like in our ovaries, for example, but then they travel through the bloodstream everywhere in the body.
So that's quite interesting. So for example, if we now focus on estrogen or estradiol, which is the most potent form of estrogen in our bodies, in the female bodies, it all starts in the brain. So you have the hypothalamus. You might be familiar with that. That's a small structure. It's like behind the nose and a little bit more up, I think. I would localize it like that. And the hypothalamus, it secretes a signal and sends it to another gland, and that's called the anterior pituitary. And that gland also secretes further signaling hormones, let's call it like that, to not make it too complicated. So it all starts in the brain with signaling. It's the FSH and the LH, so the follicle stimulating hormone and the luteinizing hormone. And they're secreted by that gland and they travel then to the ovaries in the female body. So what happens is then of the ovaries, they secrete estradiol throughout the menstrual cycle. And then at some point, the ovulation happens and the egg is being released and travels through the fallopian tube in the uterus. And if the female is not getting pregnant and the egg is not fertilized, then this releasing molecule that secreted the egg is releasing the progesterone afterwards from the follicle. Exactly. So that's how estradiol and progesterone are being secreted in the female body.
I'm just listening right now because I just finished my master's thesis on that also. That just like, I understood you, but I'm waiting for Sophie if she has backup questions because I think she's not as deep in the topic.
Please, if you have further more insights, because I sometimes think it's very hard to explain it so straightforwardly that it is super easy to understand.
No, but it does make sense. Like for me, I always more imagine or the part where after the egg was released from the ovaries, I kind of like to imagine that as the part where it kind of starts to nest in the uterus and kind of first waits if it's fertilized. And if this doesn't happen, it triggers the secretion of progesterone and then thereby also causes what will end in the menstruation. So that all the lining that was built up after the egg was released in the uterus gets sheds, and this also is kind of then associated with the menstrual bleeding. So I kind of always have this picture of, well, first the released egg makes itself cozy, just like in a living room, just kind of makes the whole uterine lining just really fluff up and get thicker. And if nothing happens, so no fertilization occurs, then it just kind of takes all its stuff, goes down, goes out, and the hormones just kind of make a whole shift in this process. So from high estrogen during the release of the egg, estrogen drops again, rises a bit again, not as much, but kind of the interplay between estrogen and progesterone then trigger the menstruation later. But I think that's just a small add-on.
Exactly. So in the menstrual cycle, as you beautifully explained, you always start with the first day of your menstruation. That is the first day of your menstrual cycle. And here, both of the hormones are quite low. And then, as I told you about the hypothalamus over the pituitary gland, they trigger this FSH, so the follicular stimulating hormones, to tell the ovaries, okay, let's release or build up, let's release a follicle. And this then leads also to the slow increase of estrogen or estradiol being secreted by the ovaries until you reach a peak. And then also together at the same time, you have that LH peak. So that is the luteinizing hormone peak also being secreted by the pituitary, and both of them peak. And that is when the ovulation happens. So when the egg is released and now travels down through the fallopian tube and then into the uterus. And over like what released the egg basically is a leftover body, let's call it like that, and that starts to release progesterone, as you nicely explained, also to build up the cozy environment in the uterus, the building up the blood. And then of course if then the egg is not fertilized in that way, it all is all being shed. But what exactly is going on with all of the different interactions and hormones, that is probably something that is a bit too extensive now for this podcast. But I definitely recommend also to look at certain graphs. They're so nice that you can look them up. And it's very easy to see then with the curves what happens and how it goes. Very hard to explain and to visualize it.
Okay. I have some more questions about the hormones still. I think most people are familiar with estrogen and progesterone being involved. If you've read about the menstrual cycle, I think you've come across those terms. But LSH, I think you said? And
FSH and LH.
Okay. I have not heard about these, which I think is quite interesting. So progesterone and estrogen are produced locally in the uterus. So one comes from the not fertilized egg and one comes from the ovaries. And the rest is produced in the brain? That's kind of my question.
Okay, so estrogens, there are different types of estrogens, first of all. So you have estrone, that is like E1 abbreviation, estradiol, so E2, and estriol, E3. And estradiol is being secreted by the ovaries and is the most potent form of estrogen that we have in our bodies. I know that it's also being secreted not only by the ovaries. And there I would have to look up where exactly also other parts or other organs are that secrete it. The estrone is also being secreted by the fat cells that we have. Mm-hmm. So for example, when a woman enters menopause, she also experiences some weight gain and maybe it gets a little bit more softer around the belly. And that's basically also the body trying to produce as much estrogen as it can. And then, of course, it starts to build up more of the fat tissue that also produces more estrogen, but it's a different form of estrogen. And then the other form of the estrogens is very high during pregnancy. So estrone is the one that is being secreted more by the fat cells, and then estriol is the one that is very high during pregnancy. So that's why we always talk about estradiol being the very potent one during the menstrual cycle, because that is what is being secreted by the ovaries during our menstrual cycle. The progesterone that we have is being secreted by what is called the corpus luteum. And the corpus luteum, it's now a very technical term, but it's basically the thing that releases the egg, the follicle with its egg, and that is the leftover. If you look up the graph, maybe in the internet, you can see that this is like a yellowish body. In German, we would say Gelbkörper, and that's also why a lot of people talk about progesterone as a Gelbkörper hormone. Maybe you've heard that. It's being pictured as a yellow body, so that's where it comes from. I believe that. So that is basically with estrogen, progesterone during the menstrual cycle. About LH and FSH, this is very interesting. So LH, the luteinizing hormone that is involved during the ovulation, and FSH, very early on during the menstrual cycle, it's the follicle stimulating hormone. Those two are being secreted in the brain, so by the pituitary, but they travel through the body as a messenger to the ovary. And basically the uterus. So these two signaling hormones have been, to my experience, just observed as signaling hormones. And I've talked about these two with another researcher also on the podcast, because at this moment, we just treat them as signaling hormones and they are very much under investigated. And we don't know, do they have other functions? We don't know. Probably they do have. What I can tell about FSH, that is actually quite interesting. So I don't know what other functions it could have, but what happens, for example, during the transition to menopause is that the FSH levels, they rise extremely. So they skyrocket at some point, because what the body does is during the transition to menopause, it's trying to produce another egg. Because what is the goal of the female body, evolutionary speaking, is to produce another egg to get pregnant. And then when the woman enters the transition to menopause, everything is being fired from the brain to produce another follicle that is not there anymore. So these levels rise and rise and rise. So you can already see in women that maybe start to have irregular cycles or they are in the transition to menopause is that the FSH levels start to rise. What other functions FSH could have, and if there are other receptors in the brain, I cannot tell you. I don't know if there's research out there, but I have, yeah, as I mentioned, I have just had that thought during a conversation with a researcher where she also said, we actually don't know that much about them.
Really cool. So still something to be like found out.
You just touched on some of the hormonal transitions a menstruating person goes through in their lifetime. Could you maybe just again explain us really shortly what they are and also in how far they might differ, in how, so as far as you can say, of course, and also with respect to the, well, not to the hormones involved, they should, as far as I know, be the same involved, but maybe in how far they change or shift differently across different hormonal transitions throughout lifespan.
Okay, I can try my best because I'm, of course, not an expert on all of the different transition phases and which hormones are involved. But to make it very simple, we talk now about the menstrual cycle, but I would really summarize it in the three major transition phases that a female is undergoing. It's puberty, pregnancy, and perimenopause. Three P's, quite straightforward. So it's puberty. It's where, of course, the sex hormones start to have then the fluctuation in the female body and basically the whole reproductive system is jump-starting. The female has the first period. It's called the menarche, and there's also very fascinating research on that in our group about this, where they have looked at a lot of different brains. So it's like it's a computational project that looked at brains and the difference that happen in females before and after menarche and how the brain changes. It's super fascinating. We can definitely link that in the show notes. And then we have pregnancy. Of course, not all females undergo pregnancy, but that is another major, major transition phase. And here the hormones are reaching absolutely crazy high levels, levels that are so far from being naturally high. Basically, of course, they are naturally high, but I know that we also talked about that, is that without pregnancy or without the transition phase of pregnancy, these levels would be so too high for any individual to experience. So that is very a lot. And the last phase every female is undergoing through is then the perimenopause. And this is then the transition to menopause. So menopause is actually only one day in a female lifespan. And that is the day where you did not have a period for 12 months. And the perimenopause is basically the transition phase to menopause, this last day. And here, when we talk about now the hormonal fluctuations, it is a period where the hormones fluctuate a lot. And for some women, it can really only take a couple of years. For some, it can take very long. So we range about 2 to 10 years of undergoing this menopausal transition. And there, as I told you about the FSH before, trying to really produce another menstrual, another egg, another menstrual cycle, the females, they undergo a lot of these transitions and can have quite regular cycles, and then they stop to have one cycle, then after a couple of months it comes back. So there is a period of a lot of hormonal fluctuations until you reach then the menopause where you did not have your period for 12 months. And after that, we consider you postmenopausal and you are not able to get pregnant anymore. You don't have any eggs left and no menstrual cycle anymore.
I like that you pointed out right now that the actual menopause is something we can only see in retrospect, because I feel like when people talk about menopause, many actually talk about the perimenopause, so the whole process of the transition, but not the single event itself, because the single event itself is just the one day you had 12 months prior realizing you haven't had your menstruation for 12 months. Well, I was just wondering, because you've also mentioned that the perimenopause can range quite a lot in time. When exactly or why does it start to kind of get away? Does a body start to get into this transition, and when?
That is a very interesting question. So that is individual for every female, because it is a matter of also your genes. So one thing that you can definitely do to have an estimation of if you're an early or later menopause female, you can ask your mother when she entered menopause, or if she entered menopause already, because that already gives you an estimation of what your chances are. Of course, that doesn't necessarily have to happen just exactly in the same way, but it is a rough estimation. So it can start quite early for some. We consider the start, it can start around, let's say, 42, 43 or something, because if you, as I said, right, the menopause transition phase can be quite long. But also some only start to show menopausal symptoms around 52. So it is really a broad range and you cannot really put it down on a certain age. And then, of course, the age around the woman that is then a menopausal, postmenopausal woman or female, she can be also exactly around the age of 50, 52, could also be earlier. So also now speaking from experience, where I do have participants that are in the menopause transition or already postmenopausal transition, I have quite a range. I have some females there that are 46 and already postmenopausal, although that's, of course, a little early. But some of them, I still have naturally cycling women or female participants there that are 52 and still don't have any menopausal symptoms at all. So it can really vary a lot. And I think it's just so important, because you're not checking your hormonal levels or the FSH levels naturally, but just important to observe your own symptoms, the cycle irregularities or early symptoms that you can experience to get an estimation. And yes, I think that is something that you can just observe for yourself. And I think that also more and more awareness is out there to observe the symptoms and see them as related to the perimenopause.
Could you maybe name some more early symptoms except for just irregular menstrual cycles?
Of course, the most known symptoms are the night sweats and the hot flushes. But that's not all. And that is also what is so fascinating for me, because now we're making a full circle moment. When I talked about hormones being essential for all kind of different functions, and actually, not only our brain and the ovaries have receptors for sex hormones, that is estrogen and progesterone, but every cell in our body. So what happens is when these hormones fluctuate and decline basically towards the menopause, every cell in your body can be affected and is affected. And of course, this does not mean that you will have all different kinds of symptoms, but it could well be that you experience symptoms that you're not immediately associating to menopause transition. So what I mean is that your hair can change. You can have gastrointestinal symptoms. You can have joint pain. You can have muscle pain later on also the bones are affected. So that's why a lot of women later on have osteoporosis. That is all starting in the menopause transition. What else can happen? Of course, mental health. We haven't talked about that. Of course, that is something that is affected. You can have your mood, your cognition can all be affected by these fluctuating hormones. And that is also how it all brings it together, that the hormones influence not only our brain and our body, but just everything together. And it is just a world where, like, you realize, okay, really everything is affected by this transition. So when also during the study, we are talking to the women that are participating in our study, and they share some symptoms with me that they have, or just whatever they experienced since they noticed the first symptoms and the first missing periods. It is just all such a symptom cluster, and there's always something that I add to this list and realize, oh, of course, this also can happen. And it's very fascinating.
So you said that the menopause, so the start of the menopause can highly vary. Do you know, or is there already a clue in research, what kind of flips the switch and decides to go into this period? Because you said FSH is rising quite highly, but I'm not sure if it's like due to the body being in a menopausal state, or if that's part of the part of the reason it goes into this state. Or
so what I would answer to that question is always the question, of course, why do humans enter menopause, right? So, and mm-hmm. that is the sense that we are born with a limited amount of eggs. And during our lifespan, whenever we have a menstrual cycle, we, let's say it like that, lose an egg if we're not getting pregnant. And so at some point in our lifespan, the body just runs out of eggs. And a pregnancy is enormously also challenging for the body. It is like I was talking about the hormones that rise super highly, but also your whole body is affected by the pregnancy itself. And this is quite a challenging thing for the female body to do. But so I think that at some point when you're a little bit older, it is also good that the body says, well, maybe I'm not pregnant anymore. And we can talk about all sorts of different evolutionary perspectives on menopause, but I think also that is not probably a bit too much for this podcast right now. But then when you're then getting a little bit more mature during your reproductive years, at some point it's an interaction of how many eggs you had, your genes. I cannot really tell what is then getting you at certain age to in this menopausal transition. I don't know if research knows. I would have to definitely look that up. But what I was talking about, the FSH, is just basically the body trying to recruit all of the remaining eggs that you have and just try one more time, basically. So it's more of it's a symptom of the menopause transition that it rises. Mm-hmm. And not the cause, I would say.
Does the level of FSH then again lower after or once you're postmenopausal, or does it stay high?
It stays high. Stays extremely high. Yeah. And that's also how we can very objectively classify the women that participate in our study not objectively classify, but just prove on top of all of the different symptoms that we know and their self-report, okay, this is also postmenopausal women. She didn't have her period for 12 months. And look at her FSH levels. It's extremely high. Yeah.
Okay. This might be a little bit of a weird question, but the FSH levels okay. I think I just answered the question myself, but I'm still going to ask it. So you probably measure blood probes from them, or how do you measure the FSH?
Yes, we do that in blood.
That makes sense.
We just now talked a bit about and how far the hormones shift through the menopause transition. And I was wondering, does that affect emotions? Because of course, I've heard that menstruating individuals, once they go into their perimenopause, they experience more mood swings again, etc. So first of all, what is known about the influence of hormonal shifts on emotions during the perimenopause? And also, does it change again postmenopausal?
Okay, there I think we are not only talking about the transition to menopause, but just all hormonal transition phases. And as I told you about that, in the brain, we do have receptors for the sex hormones in all sorts of places, also in what we call emotional networks and also emotional areas in the brain. So whenever there are fluctuating hormones during the menstrual cycle, during the transition phases, puberty, pregnancy, perimenopause, of course, emotions are affected and emotional functions are affected by these fluctuating hormones. And that is what more and more research also shows. So some women, it seems, are quite sensitive to these hormonal fluctuations. And more research exactly also shows that there is a subgroup of these individuals that are more showing more of these mental health problems or symptoms. Because, and that's also something that is very important to me when we talk about hormones affecting our brain, this is first of all not only a female thing, also males have hormones, also males have receptors in the brain for hormones. But of course, we also know that, for example, you can be a female that is not so much affected by the hormonal shifts during the menstrual cycle. Maybe you experience some menstrual pain, maybe you don't, maybe it's quite easy for you. Some during the pregnancy, they don't experience so much symptoms also after giving birth. And also there are some females or some women also that during the menopause transition, yeah, maybe they experience some symptoms, but all in all, it's okay. They transition quite easily. But there is a subgroup of individuals that suffer a lot during the menstrual cycle, during pregnancy, or after giving birth. We have the postpartum depression, for example, that is affecting a lot of women. And also then during the menopause transition, you do have, again, a rise in mental health problems for some individuals. And so more and more research is actually showing that there is this subgroup, they struggle a lot. And it seems also that if you are one of these quite hormone-sensitive individuals, you have these problems across multiple transition phases. So there also seems to be something more at core for these females.
What is, I think most people have heard of is PMS as also part of the emotional changes you experience, one experiences during a menstrual cycle. Do we know which hormones are most associated with, for example, mood swings, with negative mood, irritability, etc.?
Yeah, so that is actually quite tricky for the PMS, or the PMS, so it's the premenstrual syndrome, and then we have the disorder form, that's the premenstrual dysphoric disorder, PMDD. So PMS is actually not associated to any kind of diagnosis, it's just that you feel and you have symptoms and you feel unwell just before your period, maybe also a little bit during your period. But then it should subside. But whereas you have with the PMDD, so the dysphoric disorder, you really have depressive symptoms and depressive episodes before and during and maybe even a little bit after your period. And a long time, it has been thought that progesterone is actually the one that is causing these mood swings. And some do say progesterone could be associated with some of these mood symptoms. However, the research that I'm currently aware of shows that it's probably not a hormone thing per se. So that's not the hormones causing this, but it could rather be that for these females, they have maybe a different type of receptor sensitivity to the hormones, or some certain other structural changes or differences in the brain, functional differences. I don't dare to say more about this because, again, this is also a topic that is a research field on its own. We have also great research in our own group. So definitely check that out for what we're doing. Lots of studies running at the moment that take a further look at that. But it is more and more thought that it's not the hormones per se, because if you look at the, for example, there has been a hypothesis that individuals with PMS or PMDD, they have higher hormone levels and that's what is causing the symptoms. But no, they just have the same or similar hormone levels. So it cannot be the dosage of the hormones, for example, but probably more their response to the hormones, if that makes sense.
It's really interesting because sometimes you hear the description of like being hormonal used in a negative context, but it's actually not the hormones themselves, but rather receptorial.
Maybe. And also, I don't like to say hormonal because every one of us is hormonal, aren't we?
Yeah.
So I don't think that this is really a good thing to say. So that is also what we preach in our group, is that also males and men are hormonal. We all are hormonal. And I think it is just, it doesn't give us anything to just judge in a way. Also about the saying that, oh yeah, of course that woman has to be on her period again because she's a bit more on the edge. Nah, it doesn't really have to say that. It well can be, but then it's not, I wouldn't put it like that. There's so many different reasons where someone can be a bit more moody, and we should not blame it on the hormones.
No, that's why I put it in big quotation marks, but I just realized, obviously, our listeners won't be able to see that. So I put the word hormonal as a descriptive term in air quotations.
Yeah.
As far as I'm aware, just coming back to the maybe also a mental health perspective, I'm not sure if I am up to date with the most recent research in that regard, but as far as I'm aware, premenstrual mood disturbances, I just phrase them that way, are quite highly associated with some mental health disorders to some degree. Or at least that symptoms of mental health disorders can worsen in the premenstrual phase.
Yes, there is something that we have been talking about. I'm just thinking about this because I myself, we just talked about this also in one of our research meetings that we had, that there is this premenstrual worsening of symptoms. But I would not dare to say also more about this because this phenomenon is out there, but I'm pretty sure that it's not really clear what is going on here. Besides, it's probably the hormonal fluctuations again and the individuals having certain receptor sensitivity towards these transitions. Also, exactly, I should say that it was quite remarkable. I had this conversation also with a researcher about this whole hormonal sensitivity hypothesis. And when I talk to these, like, there are some individuals that are more sensitive to the hormones, it doesn't mean that they have to be too sensitive, but it could also be that they're too little sensitive. Do you know what I mean? So that they're not as well able to adapt to the fluctuations. And that is not so clear at this moment. Are they reacting because they're super sensitive to the hormonal fluctuations? Or is their brain not flexible enough, in a very broad speaking way, is their brain not flexible enough to react to these transitions? Because all our brains, not all our brains, the female brain changes throughout the menstrual cycle. And that happens in every menstrual cycle. There is also an amazing study that shows with, I think it was a 7 Tesla study, that brain structure changes throughout the menstrual cycle. And that in completely healthy individuals. So our brains do a lot of work out of adjusting and changing, and that's all natural and that's all happening. And so I could assume that for individuals that have mental health problems, that also interacts. That would be now my answer to that question.
I'm currently mind blown that you can see changes of the menstrual cycle in 7 Tesla images. I'm still trying to process that.
Just for our listeners, could one of you just say what 7 Tesla images mean?
Of course, I'm so sorry. Yeah. So here we're speaking about an MRI study, so magnetic resonance imaging study, where we can look at the brain structure of individuals. And what they did then is that usually if you go to the clinic and you have something for a medical purpose, you usually have 1.5 or 3 Tesla. So that's the strength of the magnetic field. And for the 7 Tesla magnetic resonance imaging study that they did, is just a crazy high magnetic field. So you can really, really, really see small structures, so tiny and small structures that are not possible to observe with a smaller magnetic field or a lower magnetic field. And so that study is very cool. We should definitely link it.
And they look... Sorry, this might be too much of a nerd question for general audience, but do they only look at anatomy or do they also look at functional images?
Oof, I think in that study they looked first of all at structure, but I don't know the paper by heart. I think it was first structure, but then also they looked at gray matter and white matter, I assume, but structure. Yeah.
That
structure.
Sounds mainly like anatomy, because then you can go like a lot below millimeters. So that's pretty cool.
But there is also research in a 3 Tesla, so lower magnetic field, about functional changes across the menstrual cycle. And there is this researcher in Austria. She's called Belinda Pletzer. She also does a lot about menstrual cycle and cognition. So she is really, really amazing. And even though our group does not do much about cognition, we're more on the, as I said, the socio-affective area, she is doing cognition and she loves everything about cognitive science too.
You also do MRI in the topic of transitional phase around menopause. Could you explain a little more what you do in that area and how and what you want to look at with that?
So the project that I'm currently doing is a quite large project where we collect different types of data. So it's a multimodal project. And we invite women that are pre-menopause, perimenopause, during the menopause transition, and post-menopause, so after having their last period. And we invite them to the lab. We do a lot of psychometric assessments. So that's basically questionnaires. Then we have our MRI sessions, so where we scan their brains. And there we do a lot of different cool stuff. So we do brain structure, but also brain function, resting state, connectivity. To all of that don't know what that is, it's basically laying in the scanner. And for us, we do show them like a movie where they see certain things opening up and closing, and they should just let their thoughts pass by. And then also we do certain tasks with them in the scanner to look at their brain activity during these tasks. And for my project, it is reward and sexual health associated tasks that they do. So in one, they play a motivational effort allocation task, and in the other, that is an erotic rating task where we look at sexual arousal in the women and try to look at the differences between the three groups. And of course, we then also assess the hormone levels in blood and to get just a very good picture of all of the different things that we do assess there.
And you just mentioned a type of task for reward, but I've never heard of said task. Could you briefly explain how that task is done?
So that the effort allocation task, that is basically a task where the participants are playing. They have to keep a ball up a certain line to get some points. And there are different conditions. So you have conditions where you can earn more or less money, basically. But also within these conditions, you have easy and hard conditions. So at some points, it's a bit of, do I want to exert effort now to get these little money and work really hard, or do I wait until I get more money and really use my effort to get the more money? So it's a bit of, it's a bit of cost-benefit analysis that the participants have to do, because it is quite hard to press the ball up. They have to do so using force in the scanner. And so we're trying to look at, are there differences in how much effort they give to a certain certain task or certain condition? And does brain activity change? Does their motivation, their behavior change? Are their tactics different? That is what we do there. Yes.
Thank you. And so I assume that you think this is going to change during the perimenstrual phase, during this transition. Why do you think something like reward or reward balance would change?
Well, I have to say that at this very moment, we don't know if it changes. So we don't have a straight hypothesis. We could form a case to say, yes, there are differences, that their reward response is going to change. Because you can do the link, of course, with mental health. You can say that reward is something that is essential to mental health. And if that is going a bit more up and down during the menopause transition phase, reward might as well be affected. Because, of course, we know if we look at now, not looking really at both females and men, females and males and men and women that are depressed, their reward response is different. And now if we then look at individuals that show these mental health symptoms, it could well be that their reward response is affected. I have to say that in our study, we're currently only collecting data from healthy participants because we just had to start somewhere. And for this moment, we just collect the data and have a look at, do they differ at all? Do they differ in their behavior? Do they differ in their neural responses, so their brain activity? One can be true without the other. So that is something to be investigated, I would say.
And the other part is about sexual arousal. So I think that's really interesting because as far as I know, that's not a topic that's generally researched a lot, especially not in older women. So how did you, why did you decide to look at that?
So we were trying to look at more, because in the IITG, in our International Research Training Group, we have this negative and positive look side on mental health too. So there are certain projects that look at stress, and then there are certain projects that look at the more positive side of the mental health, the reward and the sexual health. And we know that, of course, when I was talking about menopausal symptoms during the transition to menopause, there are also some symptoms related to sexual health. So women report, for example, about vaginal dryness, decreased libido, all of the certain things that can be affected. And we wanted to know, also have a look at what could be behind that. Could it be that during the menopause transition, something also happens on the neural level to the response to sexual stimuli that changes and then also explains the reduced libido or the reduced sexual function? So, of course, there are very, very limited research out there, especially when we're looking at the brains and the brain activity. So that's why we wanted to fill a bit of the gap, and especially because so little research has been done in these groups, especially the women that are in the transition to menopause. That is something where we can close, hopefully, the gap quite soon.
That's really cool. Okay, so we started off as a cognitive science podcast. How would you say, does your research topic link to cognition?
Okay, so even though I'm not investigating cognition very specifically with cognitive tasks that we do at the moment, I still believe that, as I mentioned before, we're not working even within the individuals ourselves, but also in research, we're not working in just one area, but it's all a dynamic system, basically. So all different kind of fields interact and influence each other. So cognition, the mental processes behind perception, attention, working memory, decision making in all of its different forms, they are also interacting with our emotions, and they're thus also influenced by our hormones throughout the hormonal transition phases, in females and males. So that is, I think, something that I would say how our field links together with cognition. And as I also refer to other work of other researchers, there's absolutely fascinating research in very this specific cognitive area, also about the neuroendocrinology part about it, and definitely something where this also plays together.
Okay, and if somebody listened to this podcast, what would you say are some good things, like one or two, to take from our conversation?
That is that the mind, the brain, and the hormones, they are in constant conversation, especially during the female hormonal transition phases like puberty, pregnancy, and perimenopause, but also, of course, throughout the day in both men and women, as I said now multiple times, that's very important. And understanding the dialogue between all these three different things is the key to support also mental health for all of us. And that is something I really wish that more research is looking into, that that has been disregarded in so many years and under-investigated. And we have to do a lot of research to understand and to get the right treatment and the right understanding of these interactions.
That's a good takeaway. And if people want to know more, you also have your own podcast, Let's Talk About Women, right?
Exactly. That is also a science communication podcast that I do, where I invite, as you do, every podcast episode, another guest, another expert on a certain topic related to women's mental health. But also we talk about sex differences, and then also men and women, females and males. We also talk about animal research and everything that goes into the women's mental health aspect.
That's really cool.
We will link the podcast in the show notes so people can find you easily if they would like to learn more about also menstruation and whatever, all the topics you cover in your episodes.
So thank you so much.
Thank you for inviting me to the podcast. I really had fun in the conversation.
Thank you so much for being here.
This was Kaleidoscience. We hope that you enjoyed this episode, and we would love to have your feedback. You can rate our podcast and give us feedback on our Instagram account. Have a great week, and you'll hear from us again in 2 weeks. This episode was hosted by Imogen Hüsing and Sophie Kühne. Produced by Imogen Hüsing, Clara Kühne, Sophie Kühne, Sönke Lülf, and Elisa Palmer. The music is from Jan-Lukas Schröder, and the logo is from Annika Richter.